Chapter 16 of Henry Ford's Own Story. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Henry Ford's Own Story by Rose Wilder Lane. Chapter 16. Enter Coffee Jim. Probably the disposition to rest on our laurels is more than anything else responsible for the mediocrity of the individual and the slow progress of the race. Having accomplished something, most of us spend some time in admiring it and ourselves. It is characteristic of big men that past achievements do not hold their interest. They are concerned only with their efforts to accomplish still more in the future. Henry Ford had built an automobile. His 4 years' work had been successful, and that little machine, scarcely larger than a bicycle, with its pulley clutch, puffing little one-cylinder engine, and crude steering apparatus, stood for an epoch in human progress. He might be pardoned if he had spent a month or two in self-congratulation, in driving the car up and down Detroit streets, and enjoying the comments of the men who had laughed at him so long. But apparently it did not occur to him. He saw already a number of possible improvements in the little machine. He was as indifferent to the praise of other men as he had been to their ridicule. After that one day of rest, he resumed almost the old routine. When a few men at the Edison plant laughingly inquired how he was getting along with the great invention, he remarked quietly that the machine was running. He had been writing in it already. Then at 6 o'clock he hurried home and out to the shed for the usual evening's work. He was trying to plan an engine which would give more power. Incidentally, in his odd moments, he was working to improve the steering apparatus. One imagines the incredulity, the amazement, that followed his quiet statement that the thing was actually running. The men at the plant began to drop around at the Ford place to look at it. They came doubtfully, prepared either to laugh or to be convinced. After they had examined the engine and looked over the transmission and steering gear, they went away still hesitating between two conclusions. "It works all right," they said. "There's no question the blamed thing runs. How do you suppose he ever happened to stumble onto the idea? But where is he going to get the capital to manufacture it? After all, there won't be much of a market. A few rich fellows will buy it, probably for the novelty. After all, you can't make a machine that will do the work of horses to any great extent." Some of them took a different view. They became enthusiastic. "My Lord Ford, there's millions in this thing, millions," they said. "You ought to get out and organize a company, a big company, incorporate and sell stock and make a clean-up right away, and then build a machine like a phaeton, with big leather cushions and carriage lamps and a lot of enamel finish. Why, there are hundreds of men that could afford to pay $2,000 or $3,000 for one of them. You could make 100% profit, 200%. Ford listened to all of them and said little. He was busy improving the machine. It did not suit him yet. He felt he could make it much more powerful and efficient with a little more work. Meantime, he revolved in his mind plans for putting it on the market. Those plans included always one fundamental point. He was resolved to make the automobile cheap. "I've got a machine here that saves time and work and money," he said. "The more people who have it, the more it will save. There's no object in building it so only a few rich men can own one. It isn't the rich men who need it. It's the common folks like me." News of the amazing machine to be seen in the old shed behind the little house on Edison Street spread rapidly. About this time, news dispatches carried word of two other automobiles built in this country. A man named Duryea of Springfield, Illinois, and another named Haynes in Kokomo, Indiana, had been working on the same idea. A reporter found Ford at work on his engine, interviewed him, and wrote a story for a Detroit paper. One or two wealthy men hunted Ford up and talked about furnishing the capital to manufacture the machine. They saw, as some of Ford's friends had done, an opportunity to float a big company, sell stock, and build a high-priced car. Ford considered these offers for a time. Building an automobile had been only half his idea. Building it cheap had been the other half, and he would not abandon it. He figured it out in dollars and cents. 200% on a small quantity of cars, or a smaller profit on a larger quantity. He showed that the most sound basis for the company was the manufacture of a large number of machines, at a profit sufficient merely to keep enlarging the plant and building more machines. The idea did not appeal to the men who were eager for large immediate profits for themselves. In the end, the men with money dropped the matter. Ford was obstinate, but he was a small man with no capital, merely a crank who had hit by accident on a good idea. He would come around all right in time, they concluded. Ford continued to work at the Edison plant and spend his evenings trying to improve his machine. He had taken Mrs. Ford to Greenfield, where she would stay with her mother until the baby was born. After that one hysterical outburst on the night the automobile was finished, she had returned to her cheerful acceptance of his interest in the car. Indeed, she herself had become enthusiastic about its possibilities. "You stay right here and keep your job with the Edison people," she said. "I'll be perfectly all right with Mother, and maybe by the time I come back, you'll have a company organized and a whole factory going. Who knows? Only mind you don't work too late at night, and promise you'll eat your meals regular." Ford promised, but when he returned to the dark little house at night and faced the task of building a fire and cooking supper for himself, it seemed to him a bigger job than building the automobile had been. He heated some coffee on the gasoline stove, burned some bread into a semblance of toast, and scrambled a few eggs. Then he spread a newspaper on the kitchen table, set the frying pan on it, and managed to make a meal. Naturally, about midnight he grew hungry. He came into the kitchen, looked at the cold, greasy frying pan, still setting on the kitchen table, remembered that he was out of bread, and thought of an all-night lunch wagon that stood near Substation A, where sometimes he bought a cup of coffee when he was working there. The automobile stood waiting in the shed. He told himself that he wanted to test the steering gear again anyway. He went out, started the engine, climbed in, and chug-chugged away through the silent, deserted streets to the lunch wagon. Coffee Jim, loafing among his pans and mounds of hamburg steak, was astonished to see the queer little machine jerking and coughing its way toward him. He remembered Ford, and while he sliced the onions and cut the bread for Ford's midnight luncheon, they talked about the automobile. Afterward, Coffee Jim examined it in detail and marveled. When Ford took him for a little ride in it, he became enthusiastic. Soon it was part of Ford's routine to drive the little car to the lunch wagon at midnight, have a cup of coffee and a hot sandwich, and a chat with Coffee Jim. They became friends. It was one of those accidental relationships which have great consequences. 100,000 Ford automobiles today owe their existence largely to that chance friendship between Ford and Coffee Jim. End of chapter 16.